Welcome to the Central Baptist Church Victoria podcast. In this series, we dive into the book of Acts. Join us as we uncover how the Spirit of God guides the family of God on a mission to share the good news of Jesus with all people in every corner of the world. Here's today's message.
Hey, good morning. I'll get you open up to Acts chapter 27. If you have your Bible with you or the Bible on your device. And we will get to Acts 27 in a little bit. One of the scariest moments in my life as a parent happened in 2013 on the Indian Ocean. We were in Africa doing some mission work when we decided to take a boat out to this marine preserve to do some snorkeling. And along with 20 or so other Kenyans, we boarded this rickety-looking vessel that seemed to be held together by baling twine and prayer. But the water was calm, and the islands that I thought we were kind of going in between, they weren't that far apart, and so I didn't give a whole lot of thought to whether or not this boat could make the trip. But that changed quickly. You can get a sense of what the way this boat was structured and engineered by the picture. As we left the shelter of the islands, our captain took us out into the open ocean, and this was when my stomach started to tighten because the waves began to grow bigger, and our boat was powered by nothing other than this small old Johnson 50 horse motor. And the boat would groan as it tried to get up every wave, and then the sound would turn to a whine as it crested the wave, and the propeller would come right out of the water as we descended down into the trough of the wave. People were getting seasick and throwing up on the boat, but the worst part was we kind of turned parallel to the coast, and we were running up the coast, and it was about 300 meters off to our side, and the coast was nothing but these jagged, like sharp rocks that stood out of the ocean like shark's teeth. And the waves were crashing against them in this explosion of foam and spray. And the ocean's tossing us around like a toy. And this little motor is belching out blue smoke, straining to push us forward. And I did this quick mental calculation that if the motor stalled, we had about around 3 minutes before the boat and us would be smashed into these rocks. And that's when my dad brain kicked in. I grabbed one of those orange safety rings and I brought it back to my wife and kids. And I said to them, hey, I want you guys to lean in close, listen carefully. I said, everybody put on your flippers right now. If the boat stalls, we're not waiting, we're jumping in. We'll put Lily onto the orange ring, and Rachel and Kimberly, you guys are gonna grab the rope on the front, and you're gonna swim out, and Sarah and I will be behind the ring pushing out, and we swim away from the rocks out into the open ocean. And my kids' eyes are like saucers, except for Rachel, who's like, awesome, right? But it wasn't awesome. For 45 minutes, I was on the edge questioning my parental decisions, my heart pounding, praying that this rickety boat would get us back safely to land. That experience gave me a tiny taste of what it feels like to be completely at the mercy of the sea. But of course, what we face was nothing compared to what Paul endures in Acts 27. Where life and death literally hung in the balance. Now, this is a situation that Paul and his companions find themselves in as they make their way toward Rome. Now, up to this point, you know, in Acts, they face everything. They face imprisonment, they face violent abuse, and now they face the terrifying power of nature itself. But in the midst of the storm, we see something incredible, that God's hand is at work in the chaos, leading Paul and everyone with him safely through it. So today, as we look at Acts 27, I hope you see how God's sovereign hand stands firm even in the most chaotic of circumstances, even in storms where we feel like life is utterly out of control, God's plans are still moving forward. And his promise to be with us. And he calls us to respond in faith and action, even in the midst of the worst storms. Now, before we dive into the storm and the shipwreck that happens in Acts 27, let me briefly catch you up on our journey that has led Paul here. As you may remember, last week we saw that Paul has been arrested in Jerusalem. He's been arrested and falsely accused of defiling the temple by bringing some unclean Gentiles into it. And this embroils Paul in what must have felt like legal quicksand. For 2 years, he is under arrest in Caesarea on the coast of Israel. He's under arrest, he's in prison, and he's constantly being dragged out to give a defense between various leaders. And his defense that he gives over and over again in those 4 or 5 chapters usually centers around 3 key arguments. I'm not going to get into them in depth. I just want to highlight them to you. Paul will bring up kind of 3 points in his defense. His first is that he believes that his missionary work is actually an act of faithfulness to God. Second, he understands the gospel, which he articulates as the fulfillment of Jewish scripture. I'm not anti-Judaism. I'm actually leading and proclaiming the fulfillment of everything that we have been looking for and hoping for. And third, in action, statement that he makes in his defense is that the resurrection of Jesus is the act by which God is going to bring light to all peoples. Now, during one of Paul's trials, he appeals to Caesar. Now, Paul, if you don't know, he's a Roman citizen, which is a rare privilege back in that day. But because he's a Roman citizen, he has the right to actually have his case heard by Caesar. And so he makes that appeal. And so Paul is being sent to Rome. Now, strategically, Rome has always been on Paul's radar. It's the epicenter of the empire. You've probably heard the phrase, all roads lead to Rome, and out of Rome, the roads go to all places. And so Paul, which he has communicated in his letter that he wrote to the church in Rome, has communicated how he wants to go to Spain. He wants to bring the gospel to Western Europe where it has not gone yet. And so he sees Rome as a strategic launching pad for that. But we know that Paul will never get to Spain. Rome will be his final destination. And now he begins his long-awaited journey there. And so we begin in Acts 27, verse 1. When it was decided that we were to sail to Italy, they handed over Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion named Julius of the Imperial Regiment. What I want you to notice is the plural we in this verse. The we tells us that Luke is with Paul. Now, Luke was with Paul 2 years prior when they traveled to Jerusalem. Remember, the Spirit warned that he was going to get arrested. Luke's been with him that whole time. He is now going back, accompanying Paul to Rome. Now, Luke's not a prisoner, unlike Paul. He's probably seen as a servant as Paul, which many Roman citizens had servants, so they probably categorized Luke in that kind of classification and allow him to travel with Paul. But interestingly, if we just kind of pause here for a sec, interestingly, that it is these 2 years while Paul is in under arrest in Caesarea Philippi, in Caesarea, that Luke most likely found the time to go and interview the eyewitnesses of Jesus and his ministry, which would allow him to write the Gospel of Luke. So Paul's imprisonment, which feels like 2 years of wasted time, may have served as a mechanism by which God gets us the Gospel of Luke. Now we read in verse 1 that there's also a large number of other prisoners on this ship. Now these are most likely, a number of them are people who've been sentenced to death for various crimes against Rome, and they are destined to the arena to amuse the population, to feed Nero's gladiator games by spilling their blood in the arena. Now, I say, if you can envision kind of the Mediterranean in your mind, they set off from the coast of Israel, and their plan is to kind of hug the coastline and go around the northern part of the Mediterranean. They're going to hopscotch from safe harbor to safe harbor because they're traveling in winter when the sea is rough and the storms are frequent and it's not super safe. So we read really early on in Acts 27 that due to the weather, they struggle to make their way west and they're actually blown off course and they're forced to modify their route. Now, Paul, who spent a lot of time on ships, he has logged a lot of, probably over 4,000 miles he's logged sailing. So Paul knows ships. He suggests that they hold up for the winter and they wait for more favorable winds and travel conditions in the spring. But the captain and the ship's owner, who only gets paid once the cargo is delivered, decided to push on and aim for a better port in southwest and the southwest side of Crete. And so we read verses 13 and 14. When a gentle south wind sprang up, they thought they had achieved their purpose, and they weighed anchor and sailed along the shore of Crete. They're on the south side of Crete, the wind blowing them towards Crete. But not long after, a fierce wind called a northeaster rushed down from the island. Since the ship was caught and unable to head into the wind, we gave way to it and were driven along. So they hope to hug the shoreline of Crete, and you'll kind of see a little map with Crete there on your right, and that green line is where they're headed. They're hoping to follow up to the top side of Crete, but what happens is that the wind now starts coming down from, coming down from the northeast. You know, it's from this way. It's coming down from the northeast, and this word for fierce wind is the Greek word, typhoonikikos, which is where we get the word typhoon, which means a hurricane force gale. And so this unbelievably powerful wind is starting to come down from the northwest, and it's blowing them away from Crete. And as much as they try to sail against it, they have to give way to it. And so let's pick up in verse 15 and continue on the narrative. Since the ship was caught and unable to head into the wind, we gave way to it and were driven along. After running under the shelter of a little island called Cauda, we were barely able to get control of the skiff. After hoisting it up, they used ropes and tackle and girded it to the ship. Then, fearing they would run aground on the Syrtis, which is the coast of Syria, they lowered the drift anchor. And in this way, they were driven along. Because we were being severely battered by the storm, they began to jettison the cargo on the next day. On the third day, they threw the ship's gear overboard with their own hands. And so if that map comes back up again, there's a little island. You can see just, will it come up again on here, the screen for a sec? I can see it up here, so I don't know if I'm, yeah. There's a little island right there. They're hoping to get to the leeward side of that island to maybe find shelter there. And so they're heading for it, but the wind is just so strong, it blows them off and it's blowing them down. Oh, it doesn't matter. I'm going to stay looking this way. I am sorry. I will not look back that way anymore. On the bottom part of that map is North Africa, where modern day Libya is now. And off the coast of Libya is something called these infamous sandbanks, which are miles offshore, but they're shallow enough that ships get caught in them. And once they're caught on the sandbank, they can't move. And the sandbank becomes the anvil, and the storm just batters and destroys ships on it. And then, you know, crews are lost. So they're desperately trying to not get blown all the way south till they hit those sandbanks. And so they're dropping anchors, they're dropping their drift anchors, they're pulling down their sails, they're lightening the ship, they're doing anything they can to try to save themselves from running aground. All right. And then we read that actually the wind is so fierce that they have to run cables. They're running cables underneath the ship from port to starboard, thank you. From port to starboard, they're running them underneath the ship and lashing it to hold the timbers together. And then also they're running cables on top of and underneath the boat from the bow to the stern to keep the ship from having its back broke from the waves. They're literally, like, if you imagine the equivalent is like your car is falling apart and you're trying to duct tape it together to keep it. That's what they're doing. This is how fierce the storm is, that the boat is threatening to break apart. They lower the sails. They drop anchor. They're throwing cargo overboard. And for 11 more days, I think there's one more map that's going to come up, but I don't know because I'm not going to look at it. There's 11 more days, they are actually blown all the way over to what is modern day Malta, the small island of Malta. And at the end of Acts 27, they're gonna land and swim ashore in on the north part of the island in a place called the Bay of St. Paul. Now, this entire journey, they are in the middle of storms. They don't know where they are. They don't know where they are in their navigation. They're barely hanging on. So 11 days, sleepless nights, fighting for their lives. They're hungry. They're exhausted. They're running on fear and adrenaline. Undoubtedly on board, every person on board has been throwing up SOS calls to whatever God might be listening. I'm sure they're flooding every possible spiritual frequency with their distress prayers and requests, because atheists hardly ever seem to be on board sinking ships, but their prayers do not get through, or their gods aren't listening because the storm rages on. And the men at this point are at their breaking point. And while everybody is panicking, and everybody is like watching their life slow motion flash before their eyes, Paul is the only one who doesn't really seem to be coming unglued, because something remarkable happens. In the midst of this storm, Paul receives a promise for the entire ship. And it's there in verse 23. This night, an angel of God, the angel of the God I belong to and serve, stood by me and said, "Don't be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar, and look, God has graciously given you all of those who are sailing with you." Paul, you're going to get before Caesar, and everyone on the boat will be spared. That is the promise. And even though the mention of the promise, even though at the mention of the promise, the winds don't die down, the sea doesn't go calm, Paul holds fast to this promise and encourages the men with it. I want you to notice that Paul is believing in the promise before anything changes. Look at verse 25. "Therefore, take courage, men," Paul says to them, "because I believe God that it will be just the way it was told to me." I kind of picture Paul in my imagination standing up, and he's yelling over the roar of the wind and the waves, and the water is breaking over him, and he's getting like, he's holding on, and he's trying, well, they're tossing about, and he's in telling them that not one of them is going to be lost. They're all going to survive the storm. "For he has faith that the promise of God will in time prove to be as real as the forces that are battering the boat." Again, notice his faith doesn't silence the storm. It doesn't remove the hardship or the turmoil they will face, but it does change how he goes through it. This is the power of faith in the promises of God. They change how we face the storms of life, don't they? Now, the realist who reads this story might rightly remind me that, well, I mean, it's pretty easy for Paul because he had an angel show up and tell him the promise, right? If that happened to you, you're like, I'm sure that would be a huge boost to my confidence that the promise that you are clinging to are not just wishful thinking, but they're actually divine decree. Right? That if God's promise to you was so serious that he would send a divine emissary to remind you or proclaim his promise to you. And you're like, well, we don't often get that. So how can we be confident toward God's promises in the midst of our storms? Well, that's a really, really good question. Glad that you asked, which you didn't, but I did for you. And I was thinking about that, and I kind of pondered two things. Two things. We find our confidence in the promise of God. We find them swell as we remind ourselves of God's track record of faithfulness. And I don't just mean his track record of faithfulness here. I mean his track record of faithfulness in your story. There are powerful stories. Every bit as sacred as the stories in here of the faithfulness of God that's been experienced by us, isn't there? Paul, of course, had his own. He saw God's hand at work in his life countless times in the past. So he had these touch points in his story where God demonstrated his faithfulness in circumstances that seemed like this is going to be a tough one for God to show up. And he would come back to, I'm sure of it, and remind himself of those touch points, which would help enlarge his faith and quicken his reflex to trust rather than to doubt. The second thing that I am sure that Paul is doing during this voyage, which I think is probably the single greatest reason why Paul was able to believe and trust in the middle of really tempestuous circumstances, is that Paul believed what the writer of Hebrews encourages us to believe. And it's this, in Hebrews 6:19, that Jesus is, quote, the anchor of our souls. You see, Paul knew that his life was forever welded to Jesus. Like they were fused together forever now. And the resurrection, which Paul saw as the center of God's promises, was so vivid and so real to him that he knew that if God was faithful to fulfill his greatest promise in the risen Jesus, rescuing us from the storm of our alienation from God, then Paul also knew that I can also trust him in the lesser storms as well. And so as these sailors are throwing their anchors overboard downwards into the depths of the deep, looking for something to hold on to, Paul is throwing his anchor by faith upwards into the heights of heaven, where the risen Jesus is seated at the right hand of God, knowing that this Jesus is very much attentive and active in the events of Paul's life. This was where his confidence came from, that somehow the purpose and the power of the risen Jesus would not let this storm swallow him. Look at verse 27. When the 14th night came, we were adrift in the Adriatic Sea, and in the middle of the night, the sailors thought that they were approaching land. They could probably hear water breaking, waves breaking off the sound of the shore through the dark, through the storm. They took a sounding and found it to be 120 feet deep. When they sailed a little further, they sounded again and found it to be 90 feet deep. They feared we might run aground in some rocky place, so they dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed for daylight to come. Some sailors tried to escape from the ship, to let down the skiff, the lifeboat, into the sea, pretending that they were going to put out anchors from the bow. Paul said to the centurion, to the soldiers, "Unless these men stay in the ship, they cannot be saved." Then the soldiers cut the boats holding the skiff and let it drop away. The soldiers so trusted Paul. Something in Paul's countenance, something in his character, they so trusted him that they cut the lifeboat free. Let's keep reading. When it was about daylight, Paul urged them all to take food, saying, "This is the 14th day that you have been waiting and going without food, having eaten nothing." That is how bad the storm is. They can't even eat, can't even make food in it. "Therefore, I urge you to take some food, For this has to do with your survival, since none of you will lose a hair from your head. Then he said these things and had taken some bread. He gave thanks to God in the presence of them all. And when he broke it, he began to eat. They all became encouraged and took food for themselves. In all, there were 276 of us on the ship. When they had eaten enough, they began to lighten the ship by throwing the grain overboard into the sea. Sorry, I read way more. I got caught up in the story. I read way more than I was supposed to. Man, I am just like not on to a game this morning. In that first part of that section, I see some real life tensions in this text here. And the tension is this. The angel tells Paul, everyone will live. God promises it. No souls will be lost to the storm. Paul is certain of this. Then as the storm rages and some of the sailors say, enough of this, and they head for the lifeboats, Paul says, if you get off the boat, you will die. What? But that doesn't make sense. You just promised that God said that everyone will live, but now you're saying if you get off into the lifeboat, you will die. Like God made a promise to all 276. So technically, they should be able to like swing from the riggings or go body surfing in the waves, because what difference is what they do if God has spoke and declared that it will happen? And this right here is a real life example of a theological paradox that trips some people up. And this story brings us face to face with the reality of God's control over everything, and yet the reality that we are still free will creatures whose choices matter. In fact, we see that God's plan unfolds through our choices, not in spite of them. Did you hear that? God's plan unfolds through our choices, not in spite of them. Proverbs 16:1 says, to a man belongs the plans of the heart, but from the Lord comes the reply of the tongue. And then he says later in verse 9, in his heart a man plans his course, but the Lord determines his step. Did you catch that? You have your own plans. Your choices are yours to make. But when you speak and when you act, those choices always fit into God's plan exactly as he intended. Now that is astounding. Like to try to get your brain to figure out how that works is enough to make it go on tilt, at least it does mine, because it means that you're free, that your choices matter, your choices are your own, and yet everything you do is somehow woven perfectly into the divine blueprint. Now how is that possible? Because doesn't it have to be either or? Either God's determination determines stuff, either God's sovereign will determines stuff, or our free will choice determines stuff. Which is it? Well, why does it have to be either? Is it not possible that God could be absolutely in control and still, in his sovereignty, not violate our free will? Is that not possible? Paul would say yes. Paul would say it's absolutely possible. God's promise was sure, but these soldiers and sailors still had a role to play. Now, this is what J.I. Packer calls an antinomy, which is a fancy word for an apparent contradiction. And Packer says an antinomy is like how light is both a wave and a particle. Like it shouldn't be both. It can't be both. And yet, it's both. And we can demonstrate and see that it's both at the same time. And we don't understand how that works, but it does. So it's a contradiction, but it's only an apparent contradiction because we don't understand the reality of it is clear that it's not a contradiction. And Packer would say that's the same principle that is at work here, that God is in control. And our choices absolutely matter. Like the nature of light, Packer says that this is not a real contradiction, it's an apparent one that we simply can't fully understand yet. But what is clear is that God is fixing, guiding, controlling all of history. And yet, at the same time, we are creatures whose free choices actually matter. In fact, as I said, God's plan is not fulfilled in spite of our choices, but through them. And part of it, like if you've played a little bit with AI and you're like, you know, you put in something and you ask a question, and it just like spits out stuff and it's responding to you. And it's like, it, you know, it begins to kind of learn your preferences and it learns, you know, kind of your idiosyncrasies and how you like to structure your email. So then it starts responding in ways that is kind of familiar to you. And you're like, how much computing power does it take for this thing to figure just out? And part of the problem is like, how much capacity, how much bandwidth does God have that he is able to take all of our free will choices and somehow still, not in spite of them, but through them, weave out his plans? It's just like, but Paul embraces both of these truths simultaneously. And he holds them in tension without feeling the temptation to diminish one over the other. And perhaps that's where the role of faith comes in. That we know the bigness of God. We know the bigness of God from how he has directed history according to exactly how he prophesied it would come out. But we also know the bigness and the power of God through what we're able to observe with our eyes, and somehow our faith in those two things with the reality that we know instinctively that your choices matter. Faith allows us to hold those two things in tension, and we don't try to club one into submission with the other. We say it's both. Somehow in the genius and power of God, it's both. Because scriptures say both are true. Certainly there's a tension between them, but the tension is only in us. The tension is not in God. Now, those who struggle to embrace this paradox, who try to, you know, make it a mathematical equation where one side wins out over the other, they, according to Tim Keller, fall into one of two ditches. They either fall into, fall into the ditch of passivity toward God, or in paralysis and fear in their own life. Let me explain. I'm just ripping this off Tim Keller. So if you don't like the idea, you can take it up with him in heaven, because that's where he is right now. And I bet you he knows this is true even more now than he did when he was on earth. This is what he means. He says, if you can't reconcile those two tensions of God's absolute control and your very real power to choose, he says, either you'll have a passivity in your spiritual life, meaning that if it's all up to God, why worry about my choices? Why does what I do and what I struggle with and how I obey and what I sacrifice, why does that even matter if it's all up to God? There's a fatalism that comes into your spiritual life that makes you utterly passive. Or if you think about it, it's all about you and your choices, so don't screw it up. You know, everything is hinging in your life on you, so you better get it right. He's like, that leads to a paralysis. Because if my whole life is self-determined by me and me alone, what if I make a bad choice? What if I don't know what choice to make? It's too much weight to just have that resting on me. But Paul is neither. He's neither passive nor is he paralyzed. He knows our choices matter, and so he's not passive in the storm. He gives leadership saying we need to do the right things the right way. But because Paul also knows that our choices are not the final word determining the future, he is not paralyzed with fear in making the wrong choice. See, if you think that your choices are inconsequential, that God just does as God will do, that everything is fixed, then you will drift toward passivity in your spiritual life. You will not work out your salvation with fear and trembling. But if you believe that your entire future just hinges on you making the right choices and not making the wrong ones, then you'll be paralyzed, or at least you should be. There's a famous short story. It's called The Sound of Thunder. You're probably familiar with this story. It's about a guy who has an illegal time machine. His name is Travis, and he takes people back into the past for a fee, and he's got a customer named Eccles, and Travis says, Eccles, I'm gonna take you back, but this is the rule. There's an anti-gravity steel path that's suspended above everything, and the one rule on the trip is you do not step off the path. Because he says, well, imagine you step off the path and you inadvertently kill a mouse. You don't just kill that mouse, you kill the billions of mice that would be born from that one mouse. And if you don't think that's a possibility, just watch what happens in Australia every 7 years, because trust me, a lot of mice come from one mouse. And then he says, for every 10 mice that are lost is a fox, and for every 10 foxes a lion, and eventually a caveman can't find food and starves, and from that one lost man, a billion potential answers are lost. So you change one thing, you affect and change all of history. That's called the butterfly effect, and that's played out into its logical extreme. Now, if that sounds like a Simpsons episode, you're right, because the Simpsons did a spoof on that. When Homer goes back in time and he squashes a dragonfly and he comes back to Springfield, and Ned Flanders is like this Orwellian dictator from 1984, and all of history has been messed up because Homer messed up and killed this one dragonfly. That's the logic. And it's a powerful story that suggests that everything in history is interlocked and interlaced. And so if it was totally determined by you, you and I do not have a millionth of the wisdom we know to figure out what impact our choices are going to make. And so if the good of the world was determined only by us, free will would be the most horrific gift. Knowledge of our free will would be the most horrific gift that God could give us. Because we'd be constantly in fear of our choices and the choices of others, because we're not insightful enough to not screw it up. But the Bible says we don't have to be afraid, because while your choices carry very real consequences, do not get in the lifeboat or you will die. God is in charge. You, Paul, will stand before Caesar, and I've given you the life of all 276 souls on board. Somehow in the brilliance, the mind-blowing capacity of God, both of these things are true at the same time. So how we respond to the storm matters, but the storm itself is always a servant to the purposes of God. And what does that mean for us today? Let me try to bring this home. That means your faith should never be passive. Faith isn't sitting back and saying, well, God's in control, so I'll just leave it up to him. Just let go and let God. Whoever coined that phrase is like, not they need to be flogged, but they need to be something. They need to be tongue lashed by a whole bunch of Christians saying, no, nowhere is that what we're called to. Just let go and let God. No. True faith moves. We are people who are faithing. Faith is a verb. Faith is an action. Faith obeys. God calls us to step out and trust him enough to take action, even when the storm is raging around us. And so maybe today, you're facing your own storm. Undoubtedly, a number of us are. Maybe it's uncertainty about the future. Maybe a diagnosis in your life or in somebody you love has really shaken the ground underneath your feet. Maybe financial struggles and stress have you feeling overwhelmed. Maybe a relationship is unraveling and the wind is howling and the waves are crashing and you feel like you're barely holding on. What does it mean to trust God in a moment like that? Well, it means anchoring yourself in his promise. It means reminding yourself again and again that he is faithful, that he is in control, that he has not abandoned you. But it also means taking the next step of obedience. If you're struggling in your marriage, trust God, but fight for your relationship, for Pete's sake. If you're facing financial hardship, trust God, but be humble enough to seek wise counsel and take some steps toward good financial stewardship. If you're wrestling with doubt, trust God, but also dig into his word. Seek out community. Immerse yourself in the truth of God. Faith is active. It is not passive. Okay, let's finish up and see how the story ends. Verse 33, which I've already read, verse 33. So I'm going to jump up to verse 37 to those of you in the booth. In all, there were 276 of us on the ship. When they had eaten enough and began to lighten the ship by throwing the grain overboard into the sea. When daylight came, they did not recognize the land. This is where they're by Malta, but sighted a bay with a beach. They planned to run the ship ashore if they could. So they cast off the anchors. They left them in the sea. They cut the anchors free. At the same time, loosening the ropes that held the rudders, when they hoisted up the foresail to the wind and they headed for the beach, but they struck a sandbar in the mouth of the bay. I added that part because I looked up where that sandbar is. And they ran the ship aground. Now, remember what I said, when ships run aground, that becomes the anvil by which the hammer of the waves break apart ships. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. The bow jammed fast and remained immovable while the stern began to break up by the pounding of the waves. The soldiers planned to kill the prisoners so that no one could swim away and escape. Let me pause there. That seems a bit drastic at the moment. But if you know kind of Roman law, if you are charged to watch over a prisoner and they get away, the consequence of your failed duty is often death. Or sometimes it's called decimation, where the 10 soldiers will line up and they'll draw straws and one of the 10 is executed. So they're like, oh, we don't want to die. We're going to kill the sailors. But, which would be a contrary to what God has promised, as you can. But the centurion kept them from carrying out their plans because he wanted to save Paul. Something about Paul's life and the choices that Paul made and the way that he lived endeared him to Julius. Julius says, this is a man that is worthy of protection. And so Paul's good choices in the past work into how God's sovereign plan works out here and how God steers this man's heart to make good choices. It's all interconnected in this passage. But the centurion kept them from carrying out their plan because he wanted to save Paul. So he ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and get to land. The rest were to follow, some on planks, some on debris from the ship. In this way, everyone reached the shore. In the end, everyone reached land safely, just as God promised. I want you to notice that the storm was a long one. God's promises and Paul's faith didn't still the storm. The ship was still lost. It was still broken apart. The waves still battered them. But God was faithful, and because they stayed on the ship, because they trusted and acted, they saw his promise. Worship team, you can come on up. Let me end with this. Storms will come. Sometimes they'll rage for days. Inevitably, they leave us exhausted, hungry, and full of fear. But like Paul, we choose to anchor our souls on Christ. We don't always get an angel's voice, but we have something that is as sure, the promises of God seen in the risen Jesus. And as we trust him, and as we act on his promises, if this is true, I'm going to act like this is true. As we do this, we stay in the boat. We cast our anchor into his faithfulness. We continue to move forward knowing that his plan is unfolding even in the storm. So let me encourage you today to take heart. Keep up your courage. Trust in the one who speaks peace through the storm and carries his people safely to shore. Let's pray. Lord, you are the sovereign Lord who holds all history in your hands. And yet in your wisdom, you work through our choices to fulfill your perfect plan. God, in every storm, in every uncertainty, help us trust that you reign so that we may be able to rest in your promises and find courage to walk faithfully in obedience, knowing that you alone are the Ancient of Days, unchanging, unfailing, forever in control. And so we worship you as a choice of our hearts and our lives. We worship you in Jesus' name. Amen. Let's stand and sing together.
We want to take a moment to thank you for listening, and we invite you to join us on Sunday mornings in person or online. For more information about who we are and what's happening at the church, visit us online at centralbaptistchurch.ca. Thanks for listening to the Central Baptist Church Victoria podcast.